May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Stanley Taylor. Mr. Taylor's convictions must be reversed in this case because of three prejudicial errors. First, a jury was allowed to consider, without any direction by the court, highly prejudicial and irrelevant evidence that Mr. Taylor allegedly engaged in similar conduct with the complainant's sister. The second is that the prosecutor, during her closing argument, told the jury essentially that the cautionary instruction that the court gave with respect to how they were to consider an out-of-court statement was not warranted. And the prejudice resulting from that was increased when the trial court abused its discretion and allowed the jury to repeatedly view the out-of-court statement. Mr. Taylor was originally charged with committing crimes against the complainant and her sister. After the close of the state's case, they dismissed charges against Mr. Taylor with respect to the sister. She had provided testimony that didn't substantiate the claims, and because the state didn't lay a proper foundation, her CIC statement didn't come in. Following that, Mr. Taylor's attorney asked the court to strike from the evidence testimony of the same nurse who examined the sister. The state objected, saying, well, she said a couple things that were relevant, primarily that he took pictures of her private parts and also that she saw her sister in bed with the defendant. The court then said that it would not strike the evidence and, for whatever reason, did not give a cautionary instruction. The testimony of the nurse...
One was requested?
Yes, he did request one.
And the reason for not giving it was what?
There was no reason stated that I recall. I think it was got overlooked after the discussion of striking the evidence. Part of the testimony by the nurse that was irrelevant and prejudicial included her testimony to the jury that the reason the sister was examined was because the parents were concerned and that the complainant had been sexually touched as well. She also told the jury that the sister was withdrawn and scared during the examination and that she found bruising in her rectum and redness in her vaginal area. She also relayed to the jury that the sister told her that the defendant had touched her breasts and buttocks three times in the last 2 weeks, had taken pictures of her, and had seen her sister in bed with the defendant. Now, the testimony of the sister herself was that she denied that she was actually touched inappropriately. She did, in fact, say that there were pictures taken of the two of them.
So let's, just to keep everything straight, call them the older sister and the younger sister.
Sure, absolutely.
As I understand it, the same nurse testified out of order.
Right.
And related what you're just telling us about, attributable to the older sister.
Yes.
Then later when the older sister testified, the older sister said there had been no direct contact with her.
Right.
Now, going back to this request for the cautionary instruction, is I understand that the defense wanted all of the nurse's testimony excluded.
Correct.
The judge found 2 points, the photographs and the contact with the younger sister still could come in, but so there was no cautionary instruction about the older sister. Was there a request for redaction in any way?
There was not a request. However, at that point, when the state was asserting these other reasons now, other purposes for this testimony, it actually became a situation a Getz analysis should have actually taken place, which it didn't, which would have included some type of an analysis as to whether there should have been redactions. And arguably, one could say that those 2 points could have been relevant with respect to, now you got me confused, I think it's the younger sister, that she did see the other one in bed with the, let me go back. Those 2 points the state asserted are arguably relevant and could have been kept in.
I understand that. But going back to your introductory comments, to the extent the sane nurse presented what turned out to be a 3507 statement about contact with one of the sisters that was later denied, and those charges were subsequently dismissed.
Correct.
As I understood your opening statement, there was no redaction.
Correct.
There was no limiting instruction.
Right.
And then when the judge later let that 3507 unredacted, no further instruction go to the jury, it compounded the problem.
Actually, those are two separate statements.
No, I understand that.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. In this case, the problem was that the testimony came in that shouldn't have, that was highly prejudicial, that while originally it was relevant, there should have been an instruction. Then you have a statement made by the complaining witnesses, the charges that remained, that she made to the CAC, that the prosecutor made an incorrect statement of the law about, and then that statement was erroneously sent back to the jury. So this particular testimony to her statement to the same nurse is separate from that.
All right. So what's the 3507 statement that went to the jury?
The complaining witness's statement to the CAC, which was the one that I'm trying to remember who's the older and younger one now. her statement, the one that the charges eventually went to the jury. Her statement, most of it contained most of the complaints. The statement contained most of the complaints. And what happened was she either denied or said she couldn't remember some things when she testified.
So the 3507 statement, your argument is that was undue emphasis, not
yes.
Inaccuracies.
Correct.
And with regard to the same nurse, your argument is that when she testified out of order and there was a subsequent denial and dismissal of the charges, that appropriate remedial action was not taken.
That's absolutely correct.
And the remedial action being either redaction or a curative instruction.
Or both.
Or both.
Absolutely.
Help me understand that. I'm looking at the state's brief, page 22. It says that the defense counsel did not request a curative instruction.
With respect to the statement, the testimony by the same nurse?
Yes. Footnote 40. Defense counsel did not request a curative instruction regarding the same testimony, nor did the prosecutor refer to the testimony in her closing statement. Therefore, the jury was never reminded of that testimony.
What I have at A101 in the appendix was that the defense attorney says, I'm going to ask the court to strike the testimony of Ashley Thompson Hill, who's the same nurse, from the record, and this court should admonish the jury to disregard the testimony since it's not necessary.
To disregard it completely.
Right.
So that was the request. Not to what is heard is admitted for a limited purpose.
Right. His argument was, none of it's relevant, and the jury should be given an instruction to tell them to disregard it. The state said some of it's relevant, and the court said, yeah, some of it's relevant, and he let everything in. No, there was no follow-up at that point as to a request for limiting instruction.
Okay, well, that's a different kind of instruction than a cautionary instruction that evidence is being admitted for a limited purpose.
Correct, and I apologize for...
Okay. So on that point, there was no request for a cautionary instruction under Getz, for example.
Right, but at that point, because the state was invoking 404B purposes of entering this evidence, under Getz, this court is required to give a limited instruction once it determines that it's relevant and conducts a balancing test, which none of which was done here. And in fact, the state talks about cases such as Vanderhoof versus State, where the court allowed in testimony that the defendant did some unlawful conduct with the same victim years before. And what the difference is, the court did a Getz analysis in that case, and the court did give a limiting instruction in that case. So despite the fact that there was no follow-up limiting instruction request, the court knew that a Getz analysis was required here, and under Getz, a limiting instruction is required.
And there was no such Getz analysis?
That's correct. He did not. He simply said, if I recall correctly, that he found it inappropriate for him to strike all the evidence.
Well, and if we wanted to be precise and consistent with the judge's ruling, what you wanted the jury to know is you can consider the testimony about contact with the other sister, you can consider the testimony about photographs, but with regard to contact with a second sister, all of that is stricken and you can't consider it for any purpose.
That's absolutely right. And the state tries to offer in its brief on appeal that there were other reasons for which the other evidence was relevant, by saying that the testimony about the developmental stage was necessary for purposes of determining the age of the children in the photographs. And none of that was argued below.
So it's our review on the limiting instruction argument you're making now for plain error?
No. I think it is for abuse of discretion, because the issue was raised as to the defense attorney was arguing the evidence should stay out. The state responded, no, here's the proper purposes. That triggered the Goetz analysis, which also requires a limiting instruction. That was properly before the court. And so it all falls under that initial objection made by the defense attorney.
Putting aside the 3507 statement to the CAC, put that to one side, was the sane nurse testimony considered another type of 3507 statement?
I don't believe it was. I think what they did was used her to say, here's what I examined and saw physically. And by the way, she said a couple of these things, and I think what the state relied on then was that it was a hearsay exception because she made those statements in the course of seeking medical treatment.
Well, that's somewhat confusing when you have the predicate for the statement being contact that required treatment, and then that whole charge is dismissed, and then you admit what was said during the course of a treatment on a dismissed charge coming in for contact with the sister and photographs.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's what the problem is with the entirety of the state's argument on appeal, that everything hinged on why she was going for treatment, what the evidence was. She talks about the prosecutor talks about the testimony by the same nurse that there was nothing absolutely showing that there had been sex abuse. Well, there was no need for her to have had said that had the inadmissible evidence not come in.
So, remind us what the record says on the necessity for doing this out of order.
What happened was, all I can recall from the record is that there was a scheduling issue. I don't know if perhaps the sister at that point could not make it in that day, or if there was school or whatever. But everybody was in agreement to allow her to come in. But I believe there was an understanding that the girl would actually come in and testify. With respect to the 3507 statement to CAC by the actual complainant that the charges were upheld on, there's two problems here. First is the jury had requested that that they see this statement again, and this was 4 days after both the testimony and the statement had been presented to the jury. Defense counsel objected, saying that he was concerned that this would put an undue emphasis on the state. The court said that it was going to use its discretion under Flannery to depart from the default rule and let the jury look at that tape again during deliberations because of the conflicts. Well, that reasoning is precisely why the court has a default rule. The court doesn't want there to be an undue emphasis placed, particularly if there's conflicting statements. The state did not object to sending it back or request that it not go back or go back.
The trial judge's action fits squarely within the Flannery exception, didn't it?
No, it did not, Your Honor, because he did not exercise proper discretion. He said that he was going to let the tape go back because there was a conflict and the jury wanted to see it. To exercise discretion, the court needs to make factual findings and legal rationale, and he didn't do that in this case. He departed from Flannery with the default rule without providing rationale for doing that. And the other problem is when they sent it back, as this court said in Lewis v. State, if the jury asks to see it, and the parties have agreed for originally not to go back, then the jury shouldn't be able to listen to it over and over again. Now, the state in its brief seems to try to indicate that the record reveals that it was shown one time during deliberations, and the record doesn't reveal that. The court said at the conclusion, after the jury asked to see the tape, to the bailiff, set up the tape so they can watch it. And there's no indication after that how many times they watched it. So his decision violated what this court said in Lewis, and it's precisely what the problem is with the reasoning for the default rule. He didn't give any further indication, because what happens is both that and the testimony was given 4 days before. There's a conflict, so we're going to let the jury see the tape, which has majority of the allegations in it. And the testimony where she denied or didn't remember a lot of it, they're not going to get to review that again, because either, you know, it's not practical, or simply they just couldn't do it.
So is it your position that even though there's an exception to the default rule, it can never be, the jury can never be given the 3507 statement during deliberations?
No, that's not my position. My position is the court needs to exercise proper discretion, and perhaps making a decision that it should go back simply because there's a conflict is not enough of a reason to depart from the default rule.
So what precisely should the court have done?
At that point, the court should have determined, you know, okay, the reasoning is it's in conflict. What's the pros and cons of this? And in certain circumstances, like in Lewis, I think would have been a good example of allowing the jury to hear one of the statements where the jury said they couldn't hear the tape. So the court, in that case, actually went too far and sent all the tapes back and let them listen to them repeatedly. But in that case, that would show you a good example of making an exception to the default rule by saying, well, the jury couldn't hear this, so what we're going to do is we're going to play it for them again so they can hear that one tape properly. Those are the types of situations that the court should consider in determining whether or not the jury...
What was argued to the trial judge for not sending it? The argument made not to send it back was what?
That it would create an undue emphasis on the statement, which conflicted significantly with the in-court testimony.
Well, wasn't that argument rejected by the trial judge when he let the evidence go back, or the 3507 go back?
Well, yes, but the reason was, because they're in conflict, I'm going to send it back. His reasoning was...
Well, isn't it implicit that it's not going to provide undue influence because the judge was not persuaded that it would?
Well, when exercising discretion, one can only know what the court's analysis is if it's put on the record. All he put on the record was it's in conflict, they want to hear it,
right.
It's going back.
So you're saying the court should have engaged in a balancing test?
Correct.
The court may have done that, but because the court didn't articulate on the record its deliberations,
right.
Then we have to treat what the court did as if there were no balancing test at all.
Right. Yes. And the other problem with that is that it violated Lewis in that the jury was permitted to see it repeatedly. So this court has said even if the jury does want to hear it, they don't get a free-for-all look at it.
Well, do we know that the jury heard it repeatedly?
We don't know that. And we know that they got it. The bailiff set it up. We don't know how many times they saw it. But they had it so that they could do that.
What was the length of this statement?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. But I do know that she at least made about 8 allegations in it, so it had to be rather lengthy.
And the length of deliberations after the jury was given the 3507 statement?
That's another good question. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, the impression that I had, and it may be totally unfounded, is that that the jury, the statement was sent back to the jury, but it was on tape, and there was a technician that played it, and would have played it only once.
There was a bailiff that asked to set the words that the court said was to the bailiff, set up the tape so they can see it. It didn't. There was nothing to indicate that it was, you know, set up one time and take it back. Basically, they're helping the jury get the video player and the tape and the video player.
But we don't know what the duration of that event was, so it could have been, there could have been an opportunity for the jury to hear it more than once, or there may not have been.
That's correct.
Well, we've used up all your time. We'll permit you to make 2 minutes of reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
If you think it's necessary, you can continue for an extra 2 minutes, too, but, you know, you don't have to.
May it please the Court, but I hope not, Your Honor. Thank you. If I may pick up where Ms. Walker left off. The words of the judge when he made the decision to send the 3507 recording back to the jury were to let them listen to it again, and he instructed the bailiff to play it again for them. And the length of the statement was approximately 61 minutes, and the jury deliberated for an hour and 20 minutes after they retired to listen to the statement before they came back and rendered their verdict. Additionally, the argument by counsel that what happened in this case is similar to Lewis.
But just so I understand the time frame, you're saying that the jury listened to the tape for 60 minutes and then deliberated for another 90 minutes?
Or yeah.
An hour, and how long had they deliberated before they asked for the tape?
No, I apologize, Your Honor. They went out initially at 11:40 and reconvened at 1:50, so approximately 2 hours of deliberation before they requested the tape. They were brought back in for the note and sent back out at 1:56 and then returned for their verdict at 3:16. So approximately an hour and 20 minutes total, including viewing time for the tape.
Which was an hour.
And the additional few minutes to reach their verdict and call the bailiff.
So they reached their verdict 20 minutes after they watched the hour-long tape?
Presumably, based on the record, Your Honor, yes. There is no indication in the record that the tape was played repeatedly or that any portion of it was emphasized in any way.
Well, it would have been impossible to play it repeatedly if they watched it for an hour and reached the verdict 20 minutes later.
Yes, Your Honor. And what the court did in this case is squarely within the Flannery exception. The jury requested it, he provided it, and in his discretion determined that it was appropriate to provide it in this case.
But the argument made to us is that there was not a proper exercise of discretion because there was no record made as to what the court, the court articulating the pros and cons and then explaining why. Allowing the jury to hear the tape outweighed whatever the con factors were.
And to my knowledge, this court has not required a balancing test once one of those exceptions has been invoked. However, the judge did take into consideration the defense argument that it would have undue influence, and he did articulate on the record that he believed in this case, due to the inconsistencies between the out-of-court statement and the in-court statement, that it was appropriate in this case. And particularly to distinguish Lewis, this case had overwhelming evidence of guilt. Lewis did not. Lewis was essentially based on that inconsistent in-court testimony and the out-of-court statement, which made the tape going back significant. That is not the case here. The state presented an overwhelming case against Mr. Taylor. It included chilling testimony and disclosures by an 8-year-old child of deviant sexual acts. It included photographic evidence that corroborated those acts. It included physical evidence.
Now, the state dropped how many charges during the trial?
After the close of its evidence, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Is that the question? After the close of evidence, there were 5 charges that pertained either to both victims, which were the exploitation charges where they were specifically named, or the charges of sexual conduct involving the older sibling who was unable to testify and establish a foundation for the 3507 statement to be played in court.
Now, what ordinarily happens, if anything, when either charges are dropped during a trial or a motion for judgment of acquittal is made on some of the charges and the judge grants the motion for judgment of acquittal, but the case does not completely end, and then suddenly the jury comes back in to hear the rest of the trial and there's a big hole in it. So what what happens then and what should happen?
As what happened in this case, the judge did instruct the jury that there were charges that were different from what were originally presented, and they were not to speculate or consider why those charges were no longer there. And the reason that nothing else was done with regards to that sexual assault nurse examiner testimony for the victim whose contact charges were dismissed was because there was absolutely no request for curative instruction or redaction. And in fact, the trial judge in this case asked counsel directly if there was anything he could do for him in that regard. He said, if there were, I would consider it. And counsel replied, no, I don't think there is.
Where is that in the record?
That is at D4, Volume D, page 4.
Where is that in the appendix?
I will find it if you give me just a second, Your Honor. I do apologize. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I cannot find that at this moment, and it may not be in there because that was piqued my interest when I saw the reply brief, so it's possible that I located that after the fact. I do apologize.
So is it your position that a tactical decision was made by defense counsel?
Absolutely. This was a passing bit of testimony in light of the volume of evidence that came in against this defendant. And the judge made a very specific decision, and the state did argue it, in fact, at D4 that I just referenced. They argued specifically that the evidence went to the remaining charges, and they did. Yes, there was a touching, but that circumstantially went to the exploitation charges. The state argued it. The judge agreed. So there was, at that point, and everybody was cautious not to highlight it because the defense had objected, which is why the state likely didn't reference it in closing.
Well, what we'd like you to do is send those pages to the court, but before you do, confer with Ms. Walker and say, I'm sending pages 1, 2, 3, whatever it is, and then see if she wants to include any other pages, and then send them all to the clerk.
Certainly, Your Honor. I do apologize. I was not aware of the procedure for that.
So your argument is that what happened here goes beyond plain error. That is, it's not a case where the court didn't take remedial action but should have on its own. It's where there was no obligation to do that because the court specifically inquired as to whether it should do anything, was told it didn't have to.
Yes, Your Honor.
From which we should infer that that was a tactical decision.
Based on the discussion surrounding it, yes, because the initial request was only to strike the testimony. After that, when the judge asked, would you like me to do anything for you, I'm willing to do it, the response was no. So a tactical decision to not have that curative. But the state submits that there was no error in allowing it in the first place because the touching, which is really the only issue, the witnessing the sister being violated and her statement that she had pictures of herself taken. I don't believe there's an issue with those so much, though, as the touching, because that was conduct that was charged in the beginning of the trial, but once those charges were dismissed, were no longer on the table for the jury. But they did still provide circumstantial evidence of the sexual exploitation charge because the state was required to prove that the nudity in those pictures was for sexual stimulation or gratification. And certainly, the touching of the breasts and buttocks would go to that claim. And because the...
I'm confused by that argument, and because the reason the charges were dropped is because the young girl couldn't testify to that effect. So, for all intents and purposes, the same nurse should not have been testifying about them either.
The charges for the older child, she was still a victim in the case for the charges that went to the jury for sexual exploitation.
I understand that, but was one of the elements of sexual exploitation touching?
No, but the state has to prove that the images depicted were for sexual gratification or stimulation. And it's to presumably avoid the scenario where a parent is taking a bathtub photo of their child. So there has
We understand that. My question is, why does the nurse's testimony about touching come in when the victim doesn't testify about touching?
In the instance that it came in because it was for charged conduct at the time.
Well, that goes back to Justice Ridgely's question. Once that charge is no longer before the jury, but the jury's heard of evidence of something that's no longer charged, shouldn't the jury be told something?
They should be given a curative instruction if it is requested, and in this case it was not. In the event that this court finds that the judge not intervening sua sponte was error, the state would argue that that error is harmless in the face of the evidence that was presented.
Let's go back to the 3507 statement for a moment. You said the reason the jury wanted the statement was because there was inconsistencies. Is that correct?
I apologize, Your Honor. The judge let the
We're talking about the 3507 statement now.
Yes.
The reason the jury wanted it was because of alleged inconsistencies.
Oh, I don't believe there's any evidence as to why the jury requested the tape.
Where does the conversation about inconsistencies come up?
The trial judge, when he was making the determination of whether or not it should go back, said that in this case he believed due to the inconsistencies that it was appropriate for the tape to be viewed again.
Right. Now, help us formulate a rule of law, because in virtually every 3507 case we have, there are going to be inconsistencies. I mean, we have the whole reason we have 3507 is because of the, quote, turncoat witness. So if you have a turncoat witness, you're going to have inconsistencies. If you have someone who just simply can't remember all of the facts, you're going to have inconsistencies. We're virtually never going to have a 3507 case without inconsistencies. So Ms. Walker's saying, given that, we ought to be looking for another reason to let the tape go back. For example, as in Lewis, they couldn't hear the tape. But is the rule you're asking us to adopt that if there are inconsistencies, the judge in the exercise of his or her discretion can send it back?
No, Your Honor. I agree with you that there will always generally be inconsistencies. Otherwise, there really wouldn't be a need to play the statement. However, I think that the discretion that comes in is, would it unduly prejudice the defendant in this case, or is it helpful in the quest for the truth? And in this case, had the jury asked to rehear testimony, the judge would have had to make the same decision. It just happens to be that they made the request regarding the 3507 tape. So I think the status of the law the way it is, with the Flannery exceptions, and then the judge exercising discretion once it is clearly in one of those exceptions.
So in terms of the rule of law, is it your position that the rule should be the same when a jury requests a 3507 statement be replayed, or when the jury requests that a testimony of a witness be reread?
Because the 3507 statement comes in as substantive evidence, it is essentially testimony, and yes, I would think that the same test should apply.
And that test is abuse of discretion?
Abuse of discretion, yes, Your Honor.
With any other parameter than that?
I think it would be very difficult to have any bright-line parameters because those statements come in under such different circumstances in a wide variety of cases with varying evidence and degrees of significance of the statement and significance of it in the case of into the witness itself. In this case, the child testified significantly. The younger child was able to testify a great deal. She just didn't hit all of the charges, so this is not a case of a witness who came in and said nothing or recanted. She just didn't give the same detail that was given in the out-of-court statement. In a different case, such as Lewis, it would appear very different to allow that testimony to be reread or that statement to be replayed because of the impact that statement would have on a jury in light of the limited or virtually non-existent live testimony that occurred from that same witness. So I don't think a bright line rule would be easy to, I certainly can't conceive of a bright line rule that would be effective. other than just the general abuse of discretion standard.
If the other side, the defense had said, well, if you're going to play the statement, the jury should also hear X, which would be counter evidence to the statement, what would that have been in this case, if anything?
I think the defense would have asked that the testimony of the child be reread, and I think that my recollection is that there was a passing reference to that he made the analogy that if we do that, we should reread all the testimony, but there was not an application for that, and certainly the jury didn't ask for it. And because the question is coming for the jury, that's important too. They're deciding what they want to rehear, what they want to listen to. It's not being dictated by the judge or by the parties. They obviously had a conflict. Before they made the request, they had apparently agreed on all charges but one. And so,
how do we know that?
That is in the record, Your Honor. I apologize. I don't know the... it would be somewhere between D85 and D90, and I apologize. Right. I don't have the exact site for that.
The way... our court works and most appellate courts work, the record includes everything, including these volumes that you're telling us about. But our rules provide that if there's a part of the record that you think it's important for the court to read, you should put that in the appendix, because the record stays here in Dover, but the five of us are all over the state. So it would be good in the future to put any parts of the record that you think are important in your appendix.
Yes, Your Honor. My apologies.
Now, the one charge that they had not decided was what?
They didn't indicate that in the note. In the argument that I would like to briefly touch on, the prosecutorial misconduct argument made by Taylor, that is a plain error standard, and this court has set out the tests for that in Baker. That the de novo review for misconduct, and then the determination of whether the error prejudicially affected the defendant's substantial rights. In this case, the answer to both of those questions is no, there was no error, and even if this court finds that the prosecutor misspoke or didn't explain herself as clearly as this court would like, it did not affect his substantial rights in any way. It also is worth noting in that analysis, the instruction given by the court was not necessary in this case due to the amount of corroboration, and that mitigates any error that this court may find in that regard. The second and third arguments, I believe the abuse of discretion standard that it applies, we have addressed fairly well, and the fourth argument wraps them all up. Mr. Taylor is asking this court to find cumulative error, and the state submits that there are no errors in this case, and
there's nothing to accumulate.
There's nothing to accumulate, and therefore, based on all of those things, the state asks that Taylor's appeal be denied and the Superior Court judgments be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, for the additional time. I'll try to be quick. Just a couple things. With respect to the instruction discussion on the prior bad acts, there was at A101 through 102 is where there's a discussion about the follow-up that Ms. Manning talks about as to whether the court could do something else for the defense, and the response by the defense attorney was not just simply no. It was, no, I don't know of anything that can be done. I mean, if there were, I would be willing to, the court said, I mean, if there were, I would be willing to consider and do it. And then the attorney says, at this point, I don't know, and then he drifts off. So there's
your argument on appeal is that you know, at least, of something that could have been done, because you're arguing that a specific instruction should have been given.
Right, and the court knew that as well, because under their Getz analysis, the court has made very clear that a limiting instruction is required. The defense attorney did not to respond to Ms. Manning, it was not a strategic decision. He said he just didn't know. And then he said, from now on, I'm not going to let the nurse testify before the victim.
So you're saying if the attorney's response had been absolutely not, Your Honor, that would be a strategic decision, but whereas here the attorney said, well, I don't know, maybe, maybe not, that's not strategic?
Well, it's not when the record shows that he says, I don't know what could be done. And then he's talking and he drifts off. I don't know if the court interrupted him or if he was just thinking out loud. So it's, what I'm saying is it's not clear from the record that it was a strategic decision. And also to address Your Honor's point about it wouldn't have been possible for the jury to watch the video more than once during deliberations. That's assuming they watched the entire thing. They could have gone back there and watched a couple parts repeatedly, we just don't know. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.